This morning, we're going to take a look at Daniel chapter 8. And we're looking at the eastern leg of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Brother Matt gave us a good look of the western leg, although there is some in Daniel chapter 7. We have Daniel's fourth beast, which actually gives us a look at both sides. So what we have a two-sided image here. And one thing I wanted to point out as I go along here, as Brother Thomas noted this, is that Nebuchadnezzar's image is basically an Assyrian image. In other words, the Assyria, meaning Assyria and Babylon, were the head. When you look at it, it's an eastern image as well, largely, but not totally, but largely, because the first three metals, the gold, the silver, and the brass, are all eastern. So therefore, what I'm trying to say is that when we look at this, these two entities, the east and the west, are associated one with another. The reason they are is because Babylon is the source. In fact, as Hyslop wrote in his book, The Two Babylons, that all systems of idolatry flowed from Babylon or Nimrod. So this is where Rome picked up its ecclesiastical understanding. It's from the east. So therefore, we know then that we're looking at a homogeneous entity, so to speak. And even though we may not see it at this time, it is one. Now, the ten toes, if you want to say it that way, another image was given in order to more clearly show the west, which was in Daniel chapter 7. It was Daniel's fourth beast, which had ten horns. You see, a man, if he had ten toes on that western leg, well, then we wouldn't have any trouble, would we? But so that image was given in order to further clarify the fact that the ten is a western entity. And what I wanted to say about this is that, and I'm getting a little bit over into the west right now, but the fact is, I never worry about will there be ten. People kick this around forever about, oh, there's too many over there now, you know, and all that. But as Brother Thomas noted, and I'll read you the barbarian entities that made up these ten that were assimilated into the Roman Empire in 476 A.D. when the barbarian invasion really hit its height. With the Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, the Gepids, the Lombards, the Franks, the Suevi, the Alans, and the Bavarians. And at the end time, all of these people are going to have an impact upon the West. There are going to be 10 there no matter what anybody says. I don't care if there's 25 there. It's still going to be based upon those 10 barbarian rulers. Well, that being said, I want to begin by looking at Genesis chapter 10. And as I said earlier, from Babylon, all sources of idolatry flowed. Well, it came from this one man, this Nimrod. And in Genesis 10, I think we've already had this reading earlier, but we're going to read it again. Genesis chapter 10, verse 8. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. And in the Hebrew, it signifies, let us rebel. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod the mighty hunter before the Lord, in the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calne in the land of Shinar, which is Babylonia. And out of that land went forth Asher. Now this is a little bit confusing. The Chaldees signifies that word means being made strong. So I think what we would say here would be that Nimrod being made strong went forth out of the land and builded Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah. So Nimrod was the founder of both Assyria and of Babylon, or Babylonia, if you want to say it that way. Babylon being the city. But the thing is what we want to say is that this is what we will see in the latter days. We will see this twofold aspect in the latter days. And in this case, it was strictly from Nimrod. But in the latter days, we're going to see an Assyrian power, which will be the Gogian power. And as someone said a class ago or so, Assyria being mentioned first will be destroyed first. And then Babylon itself will be the last destroyed. We're looking at a period over 40 years here in that destruction. Now, another thing about this, it says that, it says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. If you look at Strong's, you will find out that that word also means against. He was a mighty hunter against Yahweh, is basically what is being said there. Yeah. Now, over to Daniel chapter 8. And what I want to mention too is the fact is that when looking at these things of Daniel, Daniel was at a real critical point in history. Of course, the Jews had been taken into captivity in the eastern areas in Babylon, and he had seen many wondrous things. And then he sees these visions, and these visions were so strong to him that they made him just faint and sick for what he could see. And let's think of ourselves. I think we need to dare to be a Daniel because of the fact we're down at the right near the end of the times that he was striving so mightily to see. And here we are living at that time. And so what should our actions be? If you look at Daniel, Daniel was wanting to know more and more. He was offering all of his being. He wanted to know what was going on and what would happen. Are we that way? Because we're right down at the end time. We ought to be really striving greatly here. So I want you to keep that in mind and try to put yourself in Daniel's place. And if we can be like Daniel, anything, I'd like to even be a fraction of Daniel. But if we can do that, I think we can be a better servant in these last days in which we live. Because Daniel was a tremendous servant under trying, terrible circumstances. Well, in Daniel 8:1, it says, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first." Well, the first vision that he saw in chapter 7, a vision, it was, and Brother Thomas says this was the year 554 B.C., and whose commencement, though not numerically revealed to Daniel, may be stated inferentially as the third year of Cyrus, or B.C. 540. That's from the exposition of Daniel, page 30. So we're looking at the year 540 B.C. right here. Now, he also wrote in the exposition of Daniel that this vision, this is the second vision that Daniel got, concerned the growth of the Eastern Empire, the Eastern leg of the image, whereas the first vision, as Brother Mack has shown us, as I said, related to the rise of, more to the rise of the Western Empire, although he may he looked at the fourth beast a little bit as well. But what we need to understand then, we have a twofold aspect here. Further, we find in the exposition of Daniel that this second vision was communicated for the purpose of exhibiting certain important events in the future history of Judah, characterized by the suppression of their religious polity, the destruction of their commonwealth, and subversion of their power for a long series of ages, but with a consolatory assurance that God would avenge them and by a great deliverer destroy the power that had so long oppressed them. This is from the exposition of Daniel, page 22. And I'm going to continue what he says here. He says, "By studying the symbols of this chapter, the power will be found to originate in Babylon and to be the same as that represented by the four beasts, but without the introduction of the ten horns and a little horn with its eyes and mouth." This is what we saw in Daniel chapter 7. This was the Western, the ecclesiastical phase, the one that had the eyes, you know, the Holy See and the mouth speaking great things, which was the papal power. Now, chapter 8 is an extremely important chapter, just like all of them are extremely important, but 8 is extremely important as well. Because one thing I've always been impressed by this chapter, that the Almighty Creator has given us, through His great mercy, He's made it sure that the historic interpretation of biblical prophecy is on solid footing. And the way He has done this, He's actually given us the names of the kings of Babylon He gave us Nebuchadnezzar. He gave us, I'm going to say Belshazzar. When I say, I always used to say Belshazzar, but B-E-L is Baal, and it is the god Baal. Well, so Belshazzar, who both of these ruled during Daniel's captivity. And in chapter 8, he even names the succeeding two world empires in verses 20 and 21. I'm going to read those. We're going to be probably switching back and forth a little bit here. But says, "The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the king of Media and Persia." Well, you know, who can argue with this interpretation that we're giving when the names are given here? "And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king." You don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that the next empire was a Roman Empire. There's not a historian alive that wouldn't agree with that. You know, so I mean, we're on solid footing here. Why would anybody, why do we bring in the Arab kings and all this here? You know, here's what we have. We have a Babylonian system. And as you very well know, the Arab system, you know, the Muslims believe in one God. They don't believe in a multiplicity of gods and such. That's the Babylonian doctrine, the multiplicity. They only believe in one God, and some of them will even shoot anybody that says otherwise. So we will get into that, some of this a little bit later. Another simple point, yet a very critical point, is noted in Daniel 4:15 and 4:23. And I'm just going to, I think you're all familiar with this, but you know the Babylonian tree was cut down. And it left a stump with its roots in the earth. And these roots were banded with bands of iron and brass. That's a critical element. So we realize then that the last day's power, the last day Babylonian power will be Greco-Roman related. And what did Greece and Rome do? Their brass and iron banded about the roots kept alive this Babylonian doctrine and system. That's exactly what it was, has happened. And it's very important to understand this. Now, when you go to the Apocalypse and you see, in the 17th chapter, you see Mystery Babylon the Great, that ought to tell us something in regard to this other. So, therefore, the religious and the pagan and teachings of Babylon were kept alive and were incorporated into Christianity by Greek and Roman Catholicism. And I'm going to address this point as we go. I'm doing this a little bit different here. I thought of a different way I wanted to begin here. And in chapter 8, verse 1, King Belshazzar is noted. Now, he was the son of Nabonidus, the last king of the Babylonian Empire, the one that Cyrus removed. But he reigned as a co-regent with his father. So he has sort of a dual aspect here. Now, Belshazzar means that the god Baal protects the king. That's what it means, signifies. Now, the name Belteshazzar given to Daniel, and I know Daniel didn't give himself that name, because we know the god that he served. Belteshazzar means that the god Baal protects his life. And that was given to him. But I imagine that probably made him cringe when that was given him. I can just see it. Now, according to Hyslop in the two Babylons, I'm going to take a sharp turn here, and you may wonder where I'm going with this, but I will get there in a minute. I like to detour sometimes. I think it helps. But Hyslop noted that the heart, became the recognized symbol of the child of the Great Mother. How did that happen? The answer is the heart in Chaldee is Baal, B-E-L. Now the worship of the Sacred Heart, the worship of the Sacred Baal, that mighty one of Babylon, who had died a martyr for idolatry, I'm reading from Hyslop, for Harpocrates or Horus, the infant god, was regarded as Baal or Nimrod. See, Nimrod had more than one identity here, and I'll get to that in a minute. He was regarded as Baal or Nimrod born again, the new incarnation of Nimrod or Baal. When Baal, however, was born again as a child, he represented an incarnation of the sun so that the heart was represented as a heart of flame. The Sacred Heart of Rome is actually worshipped as a flaming heart, as may be seen on the rosaries devoted to that worship. The Catholic Encyclopedia, I have one at home, and this is interesting, states that the Sacred Heart of Jesus is a devotion to and worship of Him through His heart as representing His love, not just to the heart alone, but private veneration can use a representation of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and may be in picture, statue, medal, or the familiar badge. In the home, families are to spend an hour in reparation before the Blessed Sacrament on or before an image of the Sacred Heart between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. And those who promote this devotion shall have their names written in my heart, never to be blotted out, and I will grant the grace of final penitence to those who communicate or those who receive Holy Communion on the first Friday of 9 consecutive months. So now, what I'm trying to show here is how the West has been afflicted, you know, or how the Catholic system has taken on Nimrodian doctrine. Well, the Babylonians, in their popular religion, supremely worshipped a goddess mother and a son. And from Babylon, of course, the worship of the mother and the child spread to the ends of the earth. Now, Hyslop wrote this. Nimrod's wife, Semiramis, was worshipped by the Babylonians and other eastern nations under the name of, I think it's pronounced Rhea. It's R-H-E-A. It looks like it could be Ray, but I think it's Rhea, who was the great goddess mother. It was from the sun, however, that she derived all her glory and her claims to deification. In Scripture, he is referred to under the name, in Ezekiel 8:14, under the name of Tammuz. But he is commonly known among classical writers under the name of Bacchus, or the Lamented One. Now, in summarizing, when Nimrod died, Semiramis' wife claimed that he was deified and rose to become the sun god. He was known in classical history as Ninus. You know, Ninus means the child. In Spanish, Niña is a little girl, and Niño is a little boy. And it's funny how close the Mexican terms are related to the Babylonian, but anyway, Semiramis claimed that Nimrod came down and became her son, which was sufficient to originate the peculiar worship of the mother and son, so extensively diffused among the nations of antiquity and now so tragically exhibited in the Trinitarian doctrine originally espoused by the Babylonians. Under the Babylonians, the three persons had come to be the Eternal Father, the Spirit of God incarnate and of human mother, and a divine Son, the fruit of that incarnation. So we can see what's happened in the Catholic system from Babylon. And this identification is critical, because it is exact in the truth. Now, and again, I'm going back now. I wanted to put this out to show, you know, that how Babylon is the source of these things. Now, the first vision given in 8:1 comprehends that which I said earlier, that is what Daniel recorded in chapter 7. The second vision in verse 2 concerns the Eastern Emperor. The Eastern Empire, or the military political power of Daniel's fourth beast, and the judgments to be poured out upon it. In verses 2 through 7 of chapter 8, we find in symbolic form the conflict between the ram and the he-goat, two successors of the Assyro-Babylonian Empire. Now in verse 2 we see, I saw a vision, and it came to pass that it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan, or Susa is another word, S-U-S-A is also another spelling of that, in the palace which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Uliah. Well, in this verse, Daniel, while physically in Babylon, sees himself in the Medo-Persian palace at Shushan or Susa. This was the same location as mentioned in Nehemiah 1:1 and in Esther 1:1. This city became the throne of Persian rule when Cyrus captured Babylon and its provinces. Now, the Persian kings used this city as their summer residence. It was the capital originally of the province of Elam, which was probably added to the Chaldean territories by Nebuchadnezzar, as Jeremiah 49, verses 34 to 35 relates. Now, this Ulia River is really it's an artificial canal, actually, and it separates two rivers, the Choaspes and the Coprates, Choaspes and Coprates. This is a river that kind of went around Susa, and there's a canal that went across it. And you know, Daniel himself, when he was in Babylon, that they were basically living on a canal there as well of the river. Susa is a very interesting city. There's a lot of history to it, and I could get into a lot here, but I probably won't have time to do so. But I think I'm going to move on from there. What I probably ought to do is show this map, and I'll put this map up here and show you where this city is on the map. I hope this will show up there. Not very clear, is it? But I'm going to mark it with an X here. I can even see it from here. It's right there. So you can basically see that Susa is pretty close. It's pretty close to the borderline of Iraq and Iran, isn't it? It's right close there. I think it's Iran. It's kind of in a little more mountainous area, and that's why they use it as a summer retreat, because it was a lot cooler there. Now, how long can you leave this on without burning it up?
Hours.
Hours, good. I'm going to leave it on that way. And but in Daniel 2, we know that the breast and arms of silver represents a change in the rulership of the kingdom of men. You know, Medo-Persia captured Babylon in 539 B.C. under Cyrus. And in Daniel 7:5, this is represented by a bear, which raised itself up on one side, as Brother Mike covered, thereby showing the Persian superiority over the Median Empire. Well, the ram in verse 3 denotes the same Medo-Persian Empire as does Daniel 7:5. And also, as we read in verse 20 of Daniel 8 again, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. This is explicit. Well, the horns of unequal height also relates to Persian supremacy. Now, Brother Thomas wrote in the exposition of Daniel, page 10, that the bear of Daniel 7:5 was the symbol of this government whose dominion extended from India to Ethiopia, even over 127 provinces. He also makes a latter-day observation that for the Medo-Persian to be represented by the image in the latter days, Persia must be a constituent of the dominion represented by it. Persia will, therefore, be certainly confederate with Russia, the bear, at the overthrow of Gog. And when you look at that empire, the extent of that empire, that is a tremendous empire. And when you look at the Persian Empire, so you know what? It takes in Libya and Egypt, and it goes up and all the way over to the, right over to here, right to the border, the Indus River. It runs right up through here. Basically, I think it's more in Pakistan now, but that makes sense to me, being more in Pakistan than it would be in India, because I think India we see as one of the Eastern Tarshish powers of the latter days. So that tremendous territory we will see once again under Gogian control with the Persians and the Iranians right at their steps, so to speak. Now, in Daniel 8:4, I'm going to read this. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. You know, Cyrus was a very active conqueror. And even in 559 B.C., he became the vassal king in Anshan, or eastern Elam, a province of Elam which later became part of the Persian Empire. And he soon united all the Persians under his rule. And in 550 B.C., Ecbatana, and that's another city that's a little bit north of there. I It's harder to see right here, but Ecbatana is that one right there. Ecbatana was the median capital, and it ceased to be an independent nation when Cyrus took it. Cyrus defeated Astyages, his grandfather, and when a rebellion erupted in the Median army, but the close relationship between the Persians and the Medes was never forgotten. Thus the reigns of Darius the Mede, as noted in Daniel 9, verse 1 and 11:1, and Cyrus, the reigns of Darius the Mede and Cyrus are considered as one in scriptures. You know, advances were made even when Darius was the sole ruler. Both Darius and then Cyrus had special help in becoming great, as Daniel 8:4 and Daniel 11:1 notes. And, you know, 11:1, I really like what 11:1 says on this. I'm going to skip over just to read that real quick. It says, also I, and this I here is actually Gabriel, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. So therefore we see then that the angelic host is behind all of this. They are directing all of these things. They are shuffling the nation, so to speak, as I think someone said. And this is happening here as well. And you know, I'm just thinking, here we are in the latter days before the return of Christ. Do we think those angelic beings are among us and working now? I would be almost stunned if they weren't. I know they are. They're shuffling and they're doing things that we don't even really know. And so therefore it behooves us to be even more careful in our worship and in the things that we do and how we conduct ourselves in these last days. We need to even be more careful in what we're doing, because they're with us, around us, among us. We each one have one watching over us, undoubtedly. And these angelic beings, even though the troubles that we have in this body, these angelic beings are with us. And the true saints will be taken out of all of this trouble. And this is what this trouble is all about. It's to take out the true saints. The others, we're sorry to say, and I don't know who they are, and it may not be me, but this is what it's all about. Trouble induces an individual to either grow in spirit and in truth, or to become bitter and leave it. Those things being said, in 556 B.C., Cyrus conquered western Elam, and 7 years later he became the head of the Median Empire. And Assyria was next taken from the Babylonians in 547 B.C., and in 546 B.C., the kingdom of Lydia in Asia Minor was annexed along with its Ionian Greek dependencies. Now this brought Cyrus into contact with the Greek cities of Asia Minor and presaged the ultimate conflict with the notable horn of the Grecian goat. And ever since the days of Cyrus the Persian, rulers dreamed of conquering Greece. This was nothing new. Darius the First moved into Europe and annexed Thrace and Macedonia with little difficulty. And on that, if you can see on this map here, Thrace and here's Macedonia right here, and Thrace. See, those areas right there were the areas that that were being afflicted here. Let's see. But, you know, Greece struck back. They didn't just give up willingly here. They struck back, and they defeated Darius at Marathon in 490 B.C., and Marathon is right up here as well. Listen, all these names really don't mean anything a lot of times to me unless I can see it, but the Marathon is right here. So these great battles are all taking place in an area which we would, a Mediterranean area which we would realize is where it should be taking place. Now, it was in the sixth year of Darius the First that the temple at Jerusalem was finished, I think it was 518 B.C., and dedicated, as Ezra 6:15 notes. And his empire extended before the end of the 6th century B.C. from the Indus Valley to the Aegean, from the Jaxartes, or modern Syr Darya River in Kazakhstan, and a former province of the USSR. Now, these areas, I don't know if I can even reach it up there to show you, but these areas way out in, here's this Jaxartes River. It runs down here. That area is right on the border of Russia there, you see. So Russia is not some country that's just well removed from all of this. They're right there. And the reason that they can be so powerful in this area is that it's right on their border, you know. They're not going to have any trouble moving that huge army over into there. And perhaps even, of course, in regard to Persia willingly will come with them. Possibly, I don't know. I mean, we know that there's some nations will fall before Gog. But anyway, I kind of believe that they might even willingly do it, especially with the opportunity to get back at Israel and such. That's the kicker in all this. You know, Cyrus allowed Darius the First, or the Darius the Mede, rather, to remain as governor or king of Babylon. That's one thing. When you talk about the Medes and the Persians, he allowed him to be the big shot in Babylon. But Cyrus was really the head chief, the chieftain of all of this. Now, I want to mention something about Darius that's interesting. He was a supporter of Apollo. He stated to one who had not done what he had wanted them to do, he did not have the right attitude about the priesthood, but in disregarding my attitude, here's what Darius said, but in disregarding my attitude to the gods, you have provoked my displeasure. Unless you change your tactics, you will feel its weight. So that's what I wanted to note about Apollo is that's the Grecian symbol for Nimrod. That's a Grecian name for Nimrod. Oh, and here's Nimrod again. You know, Nimrod's all through this. You wouldn't believe how many things that are done today related to Nimrod. And we will get into a few of these as we go, but I just wanted to kind of bring that out. It helps to understand what Daniel was living through, and to show the Babylonian influence in all of this. Now, one thing about Cyrus, Scripture reveals how important he was. He was extremely important. Isaiah 44:28 reads, "That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid." And his name, as translated by Brother Thomas, is Koresh, C-O-R-E-S-H, or K-O-R-A-I-S-H, meaning like the heir. Cyrus, then, is a representative man. The antitypical Cyrus is therefore Jesus Christ. And so the life of Cyrus must relate in some aspects to the life of Jesus. Now let's look a little bit at this. Cyrus was born to a Persian father, Cambyses, and his mother was Mandane, the daughter of Astyages, who was a Mede, who was the Median king. And Astyages had a dream that the son of Mandane and Cambyses, Cyrus, would sit on his throne. That really made him angry, so then he tried to kill him. But he failed, just as Herod failed to kill the infant Jesus. Xenophon, spelled X-E-N-O-P-H-O-N, the Greek historian, wrote in about the 4th century B.C. that even in his boyhood, grown men were captivated by Cyrus's wisdom. Well, Luke 2:46-47 notes, Jesus sitting in the midst of the doctors, and all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. Xenophon also wrote of Sias' resilient or unchanging spirit and guilelessness. Well, in 1 Peter 2:22, we all are familiar with this, that Jesus did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. Sias was also a man of gentleness and mercy, according to two historians. He was righteous in his dealings with conquered peoples. The example would be the Medes. The Babylonians gladly accepted him, as did the Jews. Of course, a type cannot exceed the glory of the antitype. Cyrus had a role to play, but his acceptance of the religion of the Babylonians is far removed from what Christ will do. We know that Christ will completely destroy Mystery of Babylon the Great. Cyrus did no such thing. When he captured the city, I mean, we will see. Well, I want to have a few comments. Let's see. I'd like a few more on Cyrus, and then we'll get to some other information about it. I want to read from Isaiah 45:1. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. That's interesting. The Lord's anointed. Here we have a Gentile king called the Lord's anointed. Is that important for us to understand who this is and what his purpose is? It's incredibly important for us. Because when we think about the kings out of the sun's rising, this is what that scripture is based upon, Cyrus. Because he came in like a thief under the leaved gates and came into the city and took Babylon. Christ will come as a thief to that Babylonian system, prayerfully not to the saints, but to the Babylonian system. He will come as a thief and take that city, the antitypical Rome. Now, I want to read a couple other verses. I'm going to read in, Isaiah 41:2. I'm going to read Isaiah 41:2 just to back up what I just said. Who raised up the righteous man from the east, called him to his foot, gave the nations before him, and made him rule over kings. He gave them as the dust to his sword, and as driven stubble to his bow. This is talking about Cyrus once again. We're also going to read in 46:11. Isaiah 46:11. Calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country, yea, I have spoken it, I will bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I will also do it. So therefore, we have this great king out of the east, the king from a sun's rising, who came and overtook Babylon, overthrew Babylon, just exactly as will Christ and his anointed ones. There's no difference. Cyrus channeled the course of the Euphrates, of the literal Euphrates, that the water thereof was dried up. And interestingly enough, the water was dried up. He dried up the water to do this. And we think the drying of the Euphrates is a very symbolic part of the latter day signs that Christ will and his armies will come around and relieve Israel. So he opened the way. And I wanted to read you something from the Persian Wars from Herodotus about this. Here's what Herodotus says about this. He turned the Euphrates by a canal into the basin, which was then a marsh on which the river sank to such an extent that the natural bed of the stream became fordable. Hereupon the Persians who had been left for the purpose at Babylon by the riverside entered the stream, which had now sunk so as to reach about midway up a man's thigh, and thus got into the town. Had the Babylonians been apprised of what Cyrus was about, or had they noted their danger, they would not have allowed the entrance of the Persians within the city, which was what ruined them utterly, but would have made fast all the street gates which gave upon the river, and mounting upon the walls along both sides of the stream, would so have caught the enemy, as it were, in a trap. But as it was, the Persians came upon them by surprise and so took the city. Owing to the vast size of the place, the inhabitants of the central parts, as the residents at Babylon declare, long after the outer portions of the town were taken, knew nothing of what had chanced. But as they were engaged in a festival, continued dancing and reveling until they learnt the capture, but too certainly. Such then were the circumstances of the first taking of Babylon, and that as a thief. All right, I'm going to just switch over to chapter 5 just a second with a few comments there. I don't have time to really go into this, but once again, Belshazzar having this great feast. And you know, here he was, while Belshazzar in verse 2, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink therein. He, in effect, is thumbing his nose at the Almighty Yahweh here. You know, like he doesn't even exist. This sorry king, so if I can use the term, that's what he was doing. Well, what I want to bring about here is that the wine which they were drinking, this wine here is not just the literal wine, but this is the spiritual wine that they were intoxicated with. This nation was intoxicated, and this intoxicating teaching was exported to all nations. And this is the wine that's still being drunk of here. And this revelry and such that goes on was nothing new under the sun here today, is there, in regard to that? So we see all of this today. Now, these things help us to understand, I think, Revelation of the Apocalypse chapter 16. I'm just going to just read a little bit from there, and then we will move on. But and the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils, working miracles when they go forth into the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. There, this is nothing more than a replay of the events of Cyrus in Babylon, when we're going to see it again. Now back to our little bit of our historic look. And although there were temporary periods of splendor, the latter kings of Persia lived during times of intrigue, times of rebellion, and also great bloodshed. This is especially noted in Daniel 11:2, which speaks of the three Persian kings which followed Cyrus. And I know Brother Richard is probably going to get into this. I'm not going to spend much time on this. The only reason I want to spend any time at all on this is that I want to show, what comes out of this, and that's the question, and we will get to that in a moment. But there were four kings, and I want to mention Ahasuerus, Smerdis, Darius, and the fourth king was Xerxes. And this is the one I want to especially note, is Xerxes, because it was Xerxes. What he did is he brought the battles. He brought the Grecian Empire down upon the Medo-Persian. It was Xerxes that did it. Well, the second great battle following Marathon in 490 B.C., when I'm noted on the map up there, was at Salamis in 480. And Salamis is right off of Athens. And if I can see that here, Athens, it's basically right about in here, right about in there. So those places are real close together. It was a sea battle in 480 B.C. of gigantic proportions of that era. It resulted in the destruction of the Persian fleet and the standing up of a mighty king in Daniel 11:3. which describes the he-goat with a notable horn between his eyes in Daniel 8:5. And that's when I read Daniel 8:5. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth. On the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now, this notable horn between his eyes is none other than Alexander the Great, the first king, the king of Grecia, as noted in Daniel 8:21. And Alexander the Great was also represented by the brass of Daniel 2's image and the Grecian Empire. In Daniel chapter 8, verses 5 to 8, I probably should have read, I'm going to read 6, 7, and 8 as well. And this notable horn came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved a collar against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power of the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Well, the Greek historian, and I've always wondered if I'm pronouncing this right, but it's A-R-R-I-A-N, Arian, was born about 90 A.D., and he writes that Alexander was a great leader. He was a great conqueror, possessed of boundless ambitions. He was very much in earnest about his policy. Writers have called fusion. Fusion is an important word here. It's sort of like the word syncretism in regard to Nebuchadnezzar's image. Syncretism means that as Babylon goes off the scene and Medo-Persia comes on it, Medo-Persia absorbs the Babylonian doctrines, and then it may add a few of its own, but then next when the Greeks take over, the same thing happens. It's just carried on down. And fusion is the thing that Alexander the Great was one of his great purposes. His purpose was that the Macedonians and the Persians might live in harmony and jointly rule the empire. These exploits that led to Alexander being called the Great. Now listen to this about why he's called the Great. He had about 40,000 soldiers. That's normally was what his army consisted of. He marched them in his period of 12 years or so. He marched them 20,000 miles in 12 years. He did that in 12 years. No wonder he died at the age of 33, you know, and in a drunken stupor, as someone said. Basically, he died in Babylon. He was a Babylonian. He may have been Grecian, but he was a Babylonian, just the same. Now, Arian also writes that Alexander took his religious duties seriously, that he even believed himself to be the son of Ammon Zeus is very probable. And once again, we see the Babylonian doctrine at work. Zeus was the Greek ruler of the gods, and this Greek name, and the Greek name is applied to Nimrod. To the Roman, Nimrod's name is Jupiter. Alexander's mother Olympias declared that he came from Jupiter in the form of a serpent. Now you can see how they've all twisted all the truth to where it has no meaning. And this is what the Catholic system had incorporated into their system. You see, that's what makes it so incredible and why people can't see this, you know. In Babylon, Alexander came into close contact with the Chaldeans, and in all matters of religious ceremonies, he took their advice, offering sacrifice to Baal in particular according to their instructions. The priests of Babylon loved him. They were glad he was there. Alexander conquered Egypt and the Holy Land, and especially Tyre, as we know Ezekiel speaks about that. Ezekiel 26, verses 7 and 12. You know, both Nebuchadnezzar and Alexander afflicted Tyre. And every country in the east fell before him, as we're speaking here, as that he went against the, he went westward and northward and southward so that no one could stand before him. One thing he guaranteed to the Jews, the descendants of the refugees in the Babylonian area, he gave them the same rights as recorded to his own countrymen. So another, the Jews themselves looked upon him more favorably. And so the city he founded Alexandria in Egypt. And this was the became one of the great reservoirs of Jewish life and culture, Alexandria in Egypt. And we know this is where the Septuagint was formulated. It was in Alexandria. And so this is a very important city. Now, when you look at the Jews, when some went to the Babylonian captivity and later some into the Alexandria, into that Ptolemaic system, you have two groups. Why do we have groups such as the Sadducees and the Pharisees? It's because of the captivity they went into. The ones that went into Babylon were more the Pharisaic community. The ones that went into Egypt were more the Sadducean community. And therefore, the differences that we see in their what they understood and about, you know, the devil and all these types of things, or resurrection or whatever, is that there were differences there that they learned from each one of these areas. One thing about Alexander, again, is he introduced the Greek influence far into Asia and banded Babylonian stump's roots with brass, thereby continuing its influence. He returned to the source of the kingdom of men, Babylon, in 323 B.C., and died from alcoholism and probably the rigors of ceaseless activity on June the 13th, 323 B.C. That date's pretty exact, June the 13th, 323 B.C., and he was not yet 33 years of age. He ruled for 12 years and 8 months. And thus, as Daniel 8:8 notes, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. And remember, Brother Mac talked to us about the four winds of heaven. This is nothing but warfare existing on these Mediterranean areas. It was a great, great warfare. And Daniel 11:4 states that it shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity. One thing great about Alexander the Great, well, not great, but one thing about him that people noted was the fact that he had no heirs. And so the Grecian Empire kind of fell apart when he died, because they all looked up to him like he was a god. He was Ammon Zeus. It fell apart when he died. And if he'd have had a son, then he'd have had another Ammon Zeus, I guess, to come along and take care of him. But he didn't have one. And so this was divinely directed, undoubtedly, that because the developments that we're going to see now, the developments of the kings of the north and the south. And here's an area I'm getting a little bit edgy about, because I know Brother Richard's going to do this on Friday, and I don't know how much I can do. I had a few things to say about Daniel 11, but Richard, I know it doesn't matter, but it bothers me to do that. But the problem being here is that these Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 are companion chapters, so to speak, in much of it. And so, you know, we have to kind of we're going to step on each other's toes. I want to show. You can. I didn't realize you could see that up there, but I wanted to show Alexander's. The empire of Alexander the Great, roughly in 323, roughly when the other kings took over. And as you can see, once again, it goes all the way from, you know, through Asia Minor, a little bit of into the Greece down there, and all the way over to the Indus River in Pakistan today. And that is, again, a tremendous area. And the Persian Empire, of course, is very significant in the latter days as well. And we're looking at this. If we see Constantinople, I can't even see on this map. It blinds my eyes. There's Thrace there. Somebody's going to have to come up here and help me there. They're right here, I think. I get to where I can't see when I look at that thing. But you see why Russia desires that? Look at that Black Sea. And how do you get out of there into the Mediterranean without going through there? And all of those, the czars were all desirous of stamping out Turkey and taking it over. That's still, I think that's still in their minds to take that. We know they're going to, but I think it's in their minds, just like it was under the czars. And here's another thing I wanted to note before we got a few more minutes. And speaking of these symbols of Nimrod that we've looked at, I'm going to read you something that I ran off. In addition to Cupid, various other symbols represent Nimrod. The man of the moon illustrates that Nimrod once reflected the light of God's reasoning. The horned and cloven-hoofed Satan, the devil, and the hidden god of the underworld portray Nimrod. The title Satan is derived from the hidden god Saturn, who is the same as the horned god Kronos. Nimrod is referred to as the hidden god because the priests of the Babylonian mystery religion hid the fact that Nimrod corrupted the teachings of the one true invisible god, plus the fact that all the pagan gods are Nimrod. He is the centaur, a half-man and half-horse creature, signifying that Nimrod was the first man to ride the horse. The symbol of a fish depicts Nimrod, who the Philistines worshipped as the fish god Dagon. The Trinitarian Christians continue to use the pagan fish symbol of Dagon and deceptively contend that the Greek word for fish, which is I-C-H-T-H-Y-S, I'm not good at pronouncing that one, but it is an acronym for Jesus the Christ, God's Son or Savior. Now, what I wanted to again mention the fact is that this Babylonian system has been incorporated very clearly with a Catholic system. And I want to give you a few titles here of common names applied to the pagan Nimrod. The god of war in the Greek is Ares. In the Roman, it's Mars. And we read of Merodach or Marduk. All of these are referring to Mars, and all of them are referring to Nimrod. The god of fertility and wine is Bacchus or Dionysius in the Greek, and it's the same in the Roman, which is again Nimrod. The god of love, Eros in the Greek, and Cupid in the Roman, once again. The god of fire, Hephaestus in the Greek, and Vulcan in the Roman. The messenger of the gods, Hermes in the Greek, Mercury in the Roman. The god of the underworld, Pluto in the Greek, Pluto in Roman. God of the sea, Poseidon, in the Greek, or Neptune in the Roman. The ruler of the gods, Zeus in the Greek, Jupiter in the Roman. The father of Zeus and the horned hidden god of the underworld, Kronos in Greek, or Saturn in Roman. Scandinavian, Odin, or Wodan, W-O-D-A-N, also the founder of the Mexican race. The Egyptian, Osiris. The Babylonian, Tammuz and El-Bar, meaning God the Sun. Tammuz, in effect, is Nimrod as well, because Nimrod came down from the sun and became Ninus the Sun. The Assyrian Molech and Baal, Baal or Baalus, meaning Lord. All of these things are Nimrodian. And so that helps us to understand what the Jews are going through in their time period. You know, Baal was when the worship of the Jews of the golden calf, once again is a Nimrod depiction. And so no wonder the Almighty is so fervently despises this system and what it's done and the numbers of people that it's put in their graves for an eternity. No wonder. I suppose we'll end it right there and we'll take up a next class at about 10 o'clock.